Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. On this episode, we speak to writer, journalist and DJ Paul Gallagher, a man who's travelled the world DJing at festivals, gigs, nightclubs, after-show events for the likes of the Sex Pistols, the Buzzcocks, Soul Wax, Oasis and BDI. We'll be getting an insight into what it means to be a DJ in the digital age, how dance floor audiences differ around the world, and how, when only armed with his record collection, he went about the seemingly impossible task of appeasing a festival worth of disgruntled Oasis fans who'd just been told moments before the band had cancelled their headline slot and were officially splitting up for good. We'll also discuss how life might be different if it wasn't for the seismic cultural impact music in the 90s had on not only Paul but British society. I'll be asking Paul what it was like to be situated so close to a movement which, albeit brief, influenced fashion, art and even politics in the UK. I joined Paul in North London, where he's just returned from a UK and European tour as DJ for Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds. How's it going, Paul?
All right, mate. How are you?
Very well. How's the tour?
Tiring. It's one of them things, isn't it? Getting on and off planes and staying up all night and... Well, you know, you get on with it. Do it for the kids.
So, I mean, how does each audience vary when you play? Because I know that you did, I mean, I'm going to read out where the tour went. I think you did most of these. So, obviously, UK and Ireland, but you did Paris, went to Milan, Berlin, Copenhagen.
I skipped a few of them.
Okay, Dusseldorf?
I went to Dusseldorf, yeah. I missed Milan, Milan, Copenhagen and Berlin because it was Mother's Day weekend.
Oh, right.
I had to go see my mum.
Priorities?
It kind of got in. I would have stayed Paris and then gone from there, but... priorities, isn't it? I'm poor selves with Liam, so yeah, we had to do that. So, I missed Nottingham because we couldn't get a venue on a Friday night. I was astounded that we couldn't get a venue, but that's just the way it is when you do these things. I did most of them. I did Dublin, Glasgow, Manchester, London, Paris, Dusseldorf. Cool. I'll carry on this summer.
And, we'll get to the ones that are coming up. Compare us, like, for us, give us a comparison of, like, how audience differ from city to city.
Glasgow, they're mental. Dublin, they're mental. In Paris, they're getting mental. London's usually the same, standoffish, kind of impressed me, kind of nonsense. Manchester was great on a Monday night. I mean, a Monday night in Manchester was blinding. It's better than some Saturday nights. The audiences vary. I mean,
what about in Europe?
Yeah, Europe's interesting. Usually Paris is full of British people, but not anymore because I've been doing Paris for a while, like on and off. I done it with BDI last year, and I did it with Noel this year, and I've done it on my own a few times. And it's pretty much Parisian and French, whereas you go to Germany and it's mostly British. So yeah. And Milan is, you know, Italy, they're all metal. They just all people, kids who are up for a good time.
How does going to each city affect what you play? Do you ever try and change your set, take your set list at all?
No, they expect me to, but I just do what I want. I've run into a bit of trouble in Germany, Cologne.
Go on.
When, you know, people ask you for the usual Oasis, Moon Roses, I'm like, leave me alone. So then they just... You know, start chanting and throwing bottles at you.
Really?
Yeah. But you know,
hostile.
Slag you off from forums for 5 years after the event. And it's like, give me a break. Yeah, mud sticks apparently in Germany.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so as a you've obviously done proper tour DJs in the past for lots of people. Talk through your day. Is it like it's got to be best job ever, isn't it?
It is.
Late start, late finish.
On paper, it is. On paper, it is the next best thing to being in a band, but then you've got to take it into account. I mean, America for a DJ, waste of time, complete. Your heart will be broke.
Why?
Because especially if you're following a band on tour, you're playing till what, 2-3 in the morning. By the time you've got to sleep, and wake up, because you haven't got tour bus, you haven't got all this thing in place. You're kind of doing it on trains and whatever, 7 hours between each gig. And then by the time you turn up there, you know, their gig's on. It's basically a treadmill that you never get off. And I did the East Coast once and I said, never again. It's just, you make no money and it's just heartbreaking. It costs you more.
Cost you, yeah.
It cost me to go to America.
Really?
Forget about it. Yeah.
Don't want to open up old wounds here, man. So in regards to, like, you've obviously done stuff before bands have come on stage and that kind of thing. What's your role? What's your normal kind of, like, your remit? Is it to whip the crowd into a frenzy, or does it depend on the artist?
I mean, the Pistols thing and the Buzzcocks, and that was kind of eventful. We didn't get to DJ before the Pistols. They wouldn't let us on the stage for some bizarre reason. They wanted the stage clear, and they didn't want us anywhere near them. So that was that. But for a punk gig, yeah, you kind of garage rocky kind of 60s vibe, because they're all kind of into that. You just make sure you don't play anything by any of the bands that are playing.
Yeah.
Because you're just looking at it, no bed. So yeah, just keep it lively.
Keep it lively. And what about, have you ever DJed before a band who's kind of a bit more lo-fi, so you've had to kind of alter what you're playing and not kind of rip up the crowd into a frenzy? Like, you take the Black Rivers, I know when they were on, I know you didn't do it before.
No,
I didn't. Like that?
No, I wouldn't do it. I mean, I did it before BDI, and that was pretty good.
Yeah,
but we kind of, the band had a lot of input into what I played, because initially they let you go do your own thing. But after a bit, they're like going, hey, what was that you played? And I'm like, well, you know, and they go, well, we don't like that song. It's like, really? So we have a little bit of a, at least they're involved. After about 6 weeks, they decided to, can you play that? I went, well, it won't fit. And you kind of, you know, give them a few songs and just prove that it won't work, and then they just let you carry on your own devices.
And how do you balance, when you do a lot of your DJ sets, the after shows, how do you balance playing what you like, you know, and what the audience wants to hear? Because I know you see you get a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, some geezer the other day asked me for the House Martins, and I said, listen, mate, do you know what time it is? And he was a British guy. And I was like, the House Martins? Are you fucking DJs, never, no. And then in Glasgow, there was some other lunatic asking me for Uptown Funk by whatever his face is. I said, yeah, there's the Clash, see you later. Give me the House DJ, but I'm going home. Uptown Funk. Fucking hell. No wonder the country's knackered.
When we'd met in Paris, you got legitimately animated about DJs using USB sticks.
Yeah, because it's just nonsense. I mean, when I grew up, you go to a record shop, you buy vinyl, you listen to, you open it, you look at the cover, you listen to it, you play it to death, you know, every word of every song. You got the kids these days, got two USB sticks, plug them in, don't buy the records, predominantly steal them, download them from the internet. Most of them are pre-mixed, some of them are not. I asked the DJ the other day, I said, you got any music? He went, no.
Really?
Download off the internet. I was like, you what? I mean, I do CDs now because you wouldn't get on a plane with vinyl, and if you did get on a plane, your vinyl wouldn't be there when you got off, so. But that's as far as I go. Don't do laptops. You've got to physically do something.
What about the vinyl revival?
Yeah, great. £30 pound a record.
Yeah.
Carry on.
Yeah.
I've got the originals. Crack on with that.
Okay, so tell us about what kind of stuff goes down best at your nights.
It's a mixture. I mean, because I've done so much in all different cities, there's some people that like Northern Soul, there's some people that like reggae, there's some people that like ska, there's some people that like rock and roll, there's some that like garage rock, and they've all seen me at one point or another, so I kind of do a mixture of all them and end up with Rapper's Delight, because I need a fag or two. It's 14 minutes long, and I can go to the toilet, have a fag, couple of six, come back, it's still got 8 minutes left. It's great.
Stockholm Monsters.
Yeah.
I checked them out. That's your Twitter handle, isn't it?
They're a band from Burnage, signed to Fatsy Records in the 70s. We all live. No, no, I did an interview recently for, was it Mojo or one of them, Q?
Did he, right?
And he was trying to make it. He got it wrong, actually. Well, the Stockholm Monsters were the first band out of Burnage, signed to Factory, when they were on Palatine Road.
Right.
But he said Oasis were the second band. They wasn't. Oasis were the third band.
Who was the second?
Molly Harfed. They were signed to Playtime Records, Manchester. And Paul Barnsley formed another band called Wireless, and I signed a publishing when they were on Chrysalis in the 90s. So he's wrong, I'm right. Third band.
And Stockholm Monsters, I was checking them out. So they're Peter Hook producing.
Yeah.
I think. And how were they perceived in Burnage? Like, if they were the first band coming out,
they were like Nazis. They were like, they dressed like neo-Nazis.
Really?
Yeah, well, this is late 70s. It's like post-punk. I mean, there was a couple of brothers called the Francis, Mark France, Tony France. Yeah, and he had, like, you know, Bauhaus haircuts and mad clothes. So yeah, I was a mod at that time. So you got mods, then you got punks, then you got Teddy Boys, and you got them neo-Nazi weirdos. Well, they look weird. And you got all them within two streets of each other. and then everyone starts fighting. It's all pretty mad. I mean, you see nowadays the kids walking down the street with Led Zeppelin, Scorpions, T-shirts. It's like, if you wore that in the 70s, you'd be killed.
They have recorder solos as well. Yeah. Recorder solos. And like flute solos on the Stockholm Monsters. But on that it's pretty...
I think I had Fairy Tales on 7-inch. I think I still got it somewhere along the line. That was a good song.
Okay, so what kind of stuff do you like from the last decade when you DJ?
The last decade?
Yeah.
Which was what, the 90s?
Well, no, I'd say like 2005. Do you play anything?
Nothing.
Nothing's kind of come on your horizon?
No, I don't play anything new. Nothing.
How do you keep up with new music, or do you not?
I can't be asked.
Yeah.
Why? There's not to listen to. I mean, the odd time I'll just scour and I'll have a look around and go, right, well, what? I'll have a little dig around on Spotify and see what's hot, and I listen to it and I just go, fuck, is that it? And I'm not playing that, so I just turn myself off. I refuse to play it.
What's the difference? Why is it not good now?
There's just no passion. It's soulless. It's all very safe, all very middle class. It is, it's just crap. I mean, who's you? There was a band, you got the Black Keys,
yeah.
Then you got the other fucking band we call the Black Somethings. I think since Kings of Leon, since the first album of Kings of Leon and the Libertines' first record, nothing. And that was what, a decade ago? Nothing. And I do try to listen, but it's just, I'm just too old, can't be honest.
Excellent.
I'll get it.
Cool. Let's talk about, I've been doing a lot bit of research, and the night Paul Gallagher saved Paris. A lot of our listeners will be familiar with the night James
saved Paris.
Yeah, the night James Brown saved Boston. Well, the night Paul Gallagher saved Paris, because I believe he had to do a DJ set just after guys just split up in Paris. Tell us about that.
I was booked to play in the after show in the tent next door to the backstage, and they had the little tiff, and then that was all off, and everyone was scurrying around. I had the option to go to Milan with Liam. I had the option to go back to Paris, central Paris, or stay and do what I was supposed to do. So I stayed. Anyway, all the, you know, French journalists and this and that and the other, and fucking. And then they wouldn't pay me till 4 a.m. Oh, you had the cancellation from your. And all this fucking shit. So they won't pay me till 4 a.m. But anyway, I did it, and. It was a bit leery, but bollocks to them. I didn't cancel the gig.
You were with them in the week running up to that, and I think you said that Liam Noel turned up wanting World War IV that night. Good band name, by the way. Tell us about that night. How did it kick off?
We were on the. Where were we? We were at the City game the weekend, and then we had a day off in. It was Birmingham, and we were on our way to do V. We did V in Staffordshire. We're on our way.
Cancelled Chelmsford. I was supposed to go.
Yeah, we cancelled. Well, but I didn't even know about that, because on the bus we were coming back from the Stafford gig, and Liam was he was ill. There's double decker bus. He was ill upstairs on the bus. So.
Oh, was he like we always thought that? Oh, really?
No. It's bullshit. He generally was ill. We were having a party downstairs singing jam songs. There were about 10 of us. Then he was upstairs asleep. So then we got to the hotel. He checked in, and then I got a phone call when I woke up about 10 in the morning from Noel saying, V's off, go back to London. So we did. And then when we had to go to Paris, we got on the bus again, and no Eurostar for us, by the way, on the bus. And then into Paris, and then, I don't know, that was it. I always seem to be getting brought in on the last legs of these tours. The same with PDI in Australia and Japan. Brought in, bands split up. But anyway, bands split up. I'm like, what are you fucking trying to tell me?
Common denominator. Is there any point where like you've been kind of suggested that you might be able to reason with him being the older brother?
There's no reason. I mean, I speak to the pair of them. I see Liam nearly every other day, and I speak to Noel when I'm on his. Mm-hmm. On his little jaunts, no, this is a big business, and there's I'm sure it'll happen one day. There's too much money for it.
Not to have.
Yeah. The premier band. So, regardless of what they say, money talk.
I met Bono a couple of years ago, and he was basically just like, yeah, no one get it out of the system. It's just all part of a master plan to get them all together again.
He was my DJ partner in Dublin. That was interesting.
Good night.
Amazing. He missed his plane the next day. We had 2 days. We gatecrashed the Irish Music Meteor Awards. Like you do. They want that Bono thing. I got him in. Got him in, I guess.
Because he's quite close to Liam, and like obviously he was kind of sidelined from them in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah,
like,
we're still mates.
Does he like being back in the loop?
Yeah, no, we're mates, you know. Our parents are from the same place now, and you know, we grew up a couple of miles from each other. Just because things don't work out professionally doesn't mean you're not mates. So, yeah, I'm mates with Bonnet, so it's fun.
And have the band ever come to you for career advice?
No.
Hold a brother.
That doesn't matter.
Doesn't come into the
not career advice.
No.
I'm afraid. No, I've helped out with. I got Andy Bell in Oasis.
Did you?
I got Jeff in BDI. And I helped Kasabian get on the big stage with Oasis. Wish I didn't do that now, but anyway.
Not a fan.
No, not at all. First album was good. Rest. Not for me. How many albums are they on now? Six.
Mm.
Have they sold any records in any of them?
No.
Have they sold out the Wembley Stadium? To me, they haven't done it. They've just moulded along. They're just nicking a living, if you know. But anyway, good luck to them and get on with it.
Cool. That kind of brings us nicely onto the session musicians in regards to you introducing, say, Jeff Wootton to.
Yeah, well, I knew Jeff. I had a mutual friend. I knew Jeff from Manchester playing guitar in his bedroom, and I just asked him.
Good player.
Yeah, we were looking for a bass player, so I was figuring out which guitarist I could convert. Well, I had success with converting Andy Bell, so I figured I'd try the same tactic with Jeff.
You're very much the Cilla Black in the BDI and Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds and Oasis.
I haven't got ginger hair.
So you found you got.
I don't speak like that, like you know me. It's alright, Cilla.
You got Andy Bell the gig in Oasis, and you got Jeff the gig in BDI. What would you say is a good if we're talking about session musicians? I mean, Oasis have seen off a fair few, to be fair.
They were kind of members of the band, weren't they?
Yeah,
they never really had sessions.
I was at the O2 sound check a couple of weeks ago, and like Noel threatened to sack someone after the first song.
Really?
Like, yeah, man. Just like, I think slightly in jest, but like the atmosphere changed.
I didn't go to that gig. I was.
How would you? What gives an insight? Insight into working with big personalities. Obviously, as an older brother, it's different for you, but advice to young musicians wanting to work with big personalities.
Just make sure you work, because you'll be fired if you don't. It's as simple as that. Big guy, most predominantly bigger acts are setting the ways, you know, and if you want to survive, do as you're told.
Do as you're told. The Inspirals sacked Noel, is that right?
Yeah, no. That was back in the. In the early 90s. Yeah, we did different then. I mean, I think he auditioned to be the singer and got rejected for Tom fucking Ingley. Oh well. Different back then. I mean, he wasn't to know, was he? So I think he just, you know, I mean, that was the best thing that ever happened to him, because then he seen Liam and he had time to join Oasis and then perfect the sound.
You've done band management in the past. How would you? How would you manage Liam and Noel if you weren't an older brother? To keep them together, to keep the brand going.
You just got to keep the peace, really. And even that's not enough. You got to trust your instincts. I mean, they're both different people. I'd never get the chance to manage them because Noel manages himself technically. He just gets other brothers to do the work. And Liam's managing himself, so I'm just there in an advisory capacity when required upon.
Excellent. Okay, so let's go back to a bit of heritage. In regards to your DJ, and your dad was a DJ as well, is that right?
Yeah, he was country and western DJ.
Crossover in what you play?
No, not a fucking chance. He used to record his shit off the radio and on double tape, which is kind of, you know, pre-CD. I mean, it's kind of intriguing watching him. He'd record. I mean, this is why my dad was hilarious. He'd record Irish music off the radio, edit it, chop the fucking talking bits out, get me to go on my push bike down a long time market and sell them.
Really?
He'd have little labels on and sell his Irish mixtapes. This is about 19. This is in the 70s, and I'd be like, what the fuck? So you're nicking the music off the radio and selling it on. Genius. I mean, he must have sold about 100 maybe, but kind of funny.
And any kind of Irish music that's kind of bled into your kind of like, is there any particular musicians that you like from that area?
Yeah, I mean, I'm into the Pogues. I always have been.
Yeah.
In my younger days, I was into the Wolftones, which was kind of a rebel band, kind of abolished now. You can't really sing them anymore unless you get arrested. Who else do I admire? He's not really Irish, but Mike Scott. I love Mike Scott. He's the only guy I pay in to see. I actually buy a ticket physically on Ticketmaster to see Mike Scott. I don't buy a ticket for anyone else, but for him I do. I've got cousins who are Irish session fiddle players and all kinds of stuff. So, yeah, it's there. You can't play with your DJ. You kill. No point.
I know it's something you thought about in the past, and like, it's an ongoing project about possibly writing a book about kind of Irish
immigration.
Yeah, immigration.
It's kind of all changed now, though. It's all changed.
It's interesting, though, man. Like, say,
no, but I think the way the European boundaries have come down, that everyone's intermixed now, so it's not as prevalent. Nobody really interested in the history anymore. It's the same as I read a book about the Cromwell fucking raped Ireland and sent all the slaves to Barbados, and there's a book out there. I think it's called To Hello Barbados, which is an amazing book. And it's a period of history in Ireland that's never been told, not even told in Irish schools. That Cromwell come in, fucking England, sent all the fucking white slaves to Barbados, and that's why they call the red legs, because they get the legs got burnt in the sun. Right. And that's never been spoken about. So that kind of interests me, but you'd need millions to make a movie or anything on that, because it costs you a fortune.
Does your parents, did they talk a lot about how difficult it was coming over? I mean,
no, they had no choice. There was no work. There was no work. I mean, my mum was one of 11. It's either 14 years old, get on a train, get on a boat, come to England, work. That's just the way it was. There's no work. There's still no work now. That's just the way it is.
My mum's parents were exactly the same. They came over in 1937, so a bit earlier. My nan was one of 9. My granddad was one of 13. They came from just outside Limerick. And my granddad, his job in the Second World War was to take down. They came to London and was to take down targets for Nazis from aerial places. So that he took down like Crystal Palace and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so he worked for the British Army because he got 3 square meals a day. This war thing is totally ironic.
Yeah,
I mean, it's still going on now. It's amazing.
And no, my mum was she was saying, like, when she used to go to school, she used to walk past placards that used to say like, no blacks, no Irish, no dogs. Outside guest houses
and
stuff.
That was the title that John Lydon's put on it.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay, right.
No blacks, no Irish, no dogs.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, well, yeah, they used to have that all over the place. I think I only seen it in Manchester once when I was a kid, but when the IRA would do the bombings in 74, we used to get Irish pigs, and we slagged off by kids at school. You Irish scumbaggers! I didn't bomb anyone.
Difficult
times in the 70s. You had power cuts, you had strikes. We didn't have central heating until about the 80s. I remember going to bed with a hot water bottle. Fill your little bottle, go to bed, freezing under these furry blankets. It's all changed now. Everyone's got duvets. central heating.
Yeah, crazy. Okay, so where do you think the Gallagher family or Gallagher family would be if Alan McGee hadn't walked into King's Hutts that day, or you hadn't given Noel your guitar?
Well, he played it better. Don't know. I mean, it's just by chance, isn't it? I mean, they work well with each other. They helped McGee. McGee helped them. I mean, they were never really signed to Creation. They were doing a license because the Sony deal went through, so technically they were signed to Sony, but Sony's not too cool, so they were licensed to Creation. No, I DJ with Alan. He's a sound guy. He's done a lot for our family. Oh, we've done a lot for him. So,
but what,
vice versa.
But where would you? I mean, would you be living in London? Would your would your family? How would it, what would you be doing? What would Noel Loom be doing?
Fuck knows. Robbing houses. Don't know. No, I think Noel, as a genuine premium songwriter, would have got where he wanted to be. And I think Liam would have got where he wanted to be anyway. So, I mean, there was a few labels sniffing around him. I mean, there's a few people who wouldn't give people in their own labels $30,000 to sign Oasis. $30,000. He said, no, not worth $30,000. Creation picked him up for 35, and there you go. I mean,
the rest is history.
The rest is history. $30,000. He'd love a band like that now for $30,000. I tell you.
What was like the extended family? What was their view on them going into the music industry? I mean, was there anyone just like human thinking like, "I'll get out of your system, Liam and Noel, and settle down and like get a proper job"?
No, I think Liam. Well, Liam was a kid. Liam was only 19 when he was born his bad. 21, he was a millionaire. So he just had a party for 20 years. Noel seen a little bit more because he was on tour with the Inspirals. He toured the world with them. He knew a little bit more, and that's why he's done the smart deals.
At what stage did the family start going, "Oh, hang on, this is big, this is a big deal"? Did the penny drop?
I think it's 94. By the end of 94, the job was done, wasn't it, really? It was sold at Amersfoort Pally, which is closed now, but that was a big venue. They did the tour, they did the Forum, they did America, they did this, they did that. I think 94, they were near enough there. 95, kicked the doors in, and then from there it went on. So they just had, Noel was so smart that he had the first two albums written anyway, and luckily enough that it all fell into place with a little help from Liam and the rest of them.
Cool. I want to talk about the mid-90s. To you it might be something that was
can't remember it. Pick a year.
Okay, well, I'm going to just go back about 10 years before that. You had the miners' strike, which affected Lancashire very much. It was remembered as a significant part in Thatcher's reign, and referred to as a defining example in the golfing class division. And a lot of artists in that time wrote songs about it. So you had Ghost Town by the Specials, Town Called Malice. Then Stone Roses picked up the bat, and they had like Elizabeth My Dear, Made of Stone, Poll Tax Riots.
Smith's Queen is Dead.
There you go, yeah. And so this was a period where, like, there was a huge gulf between what was happening in modern music and the person in charge of the country. Because do you know what Margaret Thatcher said was her favourite song of all time when asked at the Brit Awards?
No idea.
How much is that doggy in the window?
Well, there you go. I mean, you got David Cameron jumping on the Smiths. It's like, "Mate, do one, you fucking tough, you know." Do you think they played that down the halls in Eton? "The Queen is Dead." Boy, do one. He's a charlatan if I've ever seen one.
4 years before, you had Gordon Brown trying to claim that he was fan of the Arctic Monkeys.
It's the kind of the same as the major music labels, where they can't invest, they can't create youth culture, they invest in it. So they see labels doing well, they just buy it up. That's just the way of the world. That's what they've been doing for decades.
So in the early 90s, Oasis kind of picked up Stone Roses' baton, and with ridiculous levels of self-belief, did songs like Rock and Roll Star, which is kind of very aligned, interchangeable lyrics with, say, "I Want to Be Adored." So it's kind of, there's an alignment there.
Yeah, and this whole it's way better. Fucking hell. Rock and Roll Star, I Want to Be Adored. There's no contest.
So this movement kind of snowballed and become a culture. You had, like, British culture. You had, like, Trainspotting being nominated for Oscars, and that was a Britpop soundtrack. Damien Hirst's art was making waves across the Atlantic.
I don't like that word, Britpop. Never have done.
No, alright.
Horrible word. John Robb, I do like you, but that's his shit word.
That was John Robb.
Britpop, British pop. Fucking hell. What were the Beatles? Were they Britpop? British pop? I just don't. It's a kind of degrading term.
Yeah.
To me it is, because it was just pop music. But they have to, journalists have to write about something and go, "Oh, it was, you know, we've defined this era, it was called Britpop." So once you define an era, you just kill it. There's no point. Why don't you just enjoy the music and fuck all that shit?
So this is what I want to play you, Paul. This is Oasis were kind of centric to all this, whatever you want to call it, but they were centric to it. And it culminated in a moment that I'm about to play you. At the Brit Awards, Oasis were voted by the public as best group, and this was the same week that the Nebworth concerts were announced and 2.6 million people applied for tickets. And in their acceptance speech, Noel said this.
There are seven people in this room tonight who are giving a little bit of hope to young people in this country. That is me, our kid, Bonehead, Quigsy, Alan White, Alan McGee and Tony Blair. And if you've all got anything about you, you get up there and you shake Tony Blair's hand, man. He's a man. Power to the people!
The drugs must have worked that night, our kid.
How did you feel at the time when Noel was kind of getting in bed with, like... Because you didn't know at the time, it was Good World, but with Tony Blair and, like, Alistair Campbell just saw it as an opportunity to go on the coattails.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I just,
did you realise he was being played?
I just sort of noticed it. I mean, because I think I was the time I moved to London, and I knew if I didn't buy a property... I knew when there's election, there's always an upturn in fortunes, and I figured that he'd get in, so I'd need to buy a house quick before it went up. So I did. So thank you for that, Mr. Tony Blair. But for everything else, war criminal and all that, sugar.
Within a year of Noel saying that, Tony Blair was in power as the youngest ever prime minister in 200 years, and he had the largest majority vote of people on the 30.
I've never voted, and then not voted for Labour since the 80s in Manchester. I just, you know, they're not a socialist party, they're not left field, they're just basically the fucking Tories with a red badge on.
Yeah, you're right.
They're all the same. I mean, I'm voting next week for the first, I think, I don't think I've ever voted in London, but I am going to vote. I'm going to vote for the Green Party.
Good man.
Because I like juices.
There we go. Outside Planet Organic.
I'm going to vote for the Green Party. What about Trident? What fucking about Trident? You think that's going to stop the Russians? Some fucking silly little thing? No one. What about mending the fucking pavements in the not so rich places? Hey, fucking hell. Councils.
Cool. Alright, let's talk about, if you don't mind me, just your relationship with Liam and Noel. The press always talk about Liam and Noel's relationship, but I would say without question, you've had more influence on Liam than Noel ever possibly could have. I mean, met all three of you, the way your mannerisms, the way you are. Do you think that's because you, the older brother, he looked up to you? Did you look out for Liam as a kid?
Yeah, I mean, we, Noel had left home by the time he was 17. He'd gone where he's gone, and there was only me and Liam there. Liam was a kid, so and that was kind of it. And we live, we're 2 miles away from each other. We see each other. We talk to speak every day. See each other a couple of times a week, so yeah, he's my younger brother, isn't he? I mean, he's my youngest brother, so you've got to look out for, you know, you've got to look out for your family. Noel can look out for himself, but you know, Liam, you know, what you do.
He never liked guitar bands, but you got him into them, is that right?
Yeah, Liam just loved scratching my records, taking them to primary school, and it's like, yeah, mate, do you know how fucking many holes I've had to dig to buy that fucking record, and you've gone and scratched it?
What are you on about, dickhead?
It's like, what am I on about, dickhead? Come here, and we just start fighting. 7 years old or not, don't fucking nick my records.
So what was he into?
Don't scratch them. I think he was in a breakdancing.
Fuck off.
Yeah. Well, no, wait. Hey, there's a lot of shit.
A 7 year old Liam Gallagher
breakdancing. I remember him breakdancing. I remember Noel dressed as a rockabilly. We haven't got the picture, so we didn't have a camera back in them days, but yeah.
Oh, that's where the...
It wasn't all mods. I was the fucking mod.
So
anyway,
Noel was dressed as a rockabilly. That's where the new version of Fadeaway comes from.
He was a rockabilly. Liam used to spin his head with a bit of lino. I was just... That was my nickname, Bod the Mod. So, there you go.
Cool.
But now I kind of cringe when I see all these kids with parkas on thinking it's the 70s. I'm like, ugh, fuck off.
But you've had a lot of influence, because I know you're really into clothes, like, as a young person, and, like, the guitar and your musical taste. So you had quite a lot of oversight in, like, Liam's development. How have you seen him change? Because now he obviously owns his business Pretty Green, and that's a fashion...
Yeah, he's just sold another store in Tokyo, so that makes it, I think, about 8 in Japan. No, he's doing well. That clothing company, with all its knockers at the start, he's turned over a serious amount of money. So, I mean, fair play to him. You know, he's stuck at it, and he's doing his thing. I've seen him go from a boy to a man. I mean, it's kind of weird watching your youngest brother go from living at home with your mum to living with Patsy Kensit in about the space of 2 years, and you're like going, wow. And then, you know, and then you go on tour with them, and they're he gets mobbed, man. Obviously, he's open, he's just turn up. It is kind of mental to get your red round, but you know, once you, that's his thing, just let him get on with it. That's what he's got to do, that's his job, so it's all good.
Cool. And in regards to Noel, I'm always interested in how, like, say Peggy, for instance, saw him as, like, the, you referred to Peggy calling him the mummy's little blue-eyed boy. How did, like, all the naughty stuff go down with the rest of the family? Did they kind of brush it off, or was that kind
well,
of...
Well, I mean, it was... Because we started off collecting scrapbooks way back in the day, 91. I think my mum's got about 70 now. She must have. I mean, for all... And then, you know, obviously she'd buy every paper and she'd cut out the bits and she'd be looking at it going... Oh, well, that's not a very clever thing to be saying. No. So, my brother's kind of opened her. I mean, she's very streetwise for a 70-odd-year-old woman. She knows everything about drugs, because they kept mentioning it. You know, it's like...
Conflict and all that.
Spring, yeah, and it's like, my mum's like going, you better not be on them. I says, listen, I'm a saint, it's not me. So that kind of thing. Yeah, I think it opened her eyes to all kinds of shenanigans. Good and bad.
I want to move on quickly. I know you're really into Motown stuff. You talked about Motown stuff.
Well, I mean, yeah,
I'm
more into Northern, the stompers of Northern Soul, not really the slow ones. I've done the Northern Soul night, which I did say to the promoter, I said, don't bill me as a Northern Soul DJ, because I'm in Scunthorpe and they got this bouncy floor, and I know it's their big night out, and they pay £3 in, and that's a fucking lot of money for them, and they're going to get on my case if I don't play any Northern Soul. Which I probably don't, predominantly don't. So anyway, went there, fucking hell, they're eating pie and peas, and they're fucking like, hey, you know what, our dance floor is empty. I said, yeah, because you're all eating food. He went, no, because you're not playing any Northern Soul. And I went, listen, fuck you. So the next track I did, but it was a stomper, and there was a geezer sat in the corner with his fans falling, going, no, this is not what I pay me money in for.
Yeah.
I was like, fuck you, I can't go cater into some old geezer who used to bounce around when he was fucking 20, when he's now in his 60s, and he's got a hip replacement. I can't do that.
I think you said the song that gets people on the dance floor most is "I Want You Back," Jackson
yeah,
5. Is that right?
Well, no, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I didn't predominantly start. I think I played the Jacksons one night by mistake because I don't sometimes wear headphones and sometimes don't. So I think I pressed
shoot them by accident.
Yeah, and the place went fucking mental. And I was like, going, oh shit.
No,
I don't play that anymore. I carry "Don't Stop" till you get enough. That's kind of always handy because girls dance to it. And while girls are dancing, guys ain't leaving that dance floor because they're going to be stood next to girls. So it's a win-win situation. And you just see them going, I don't really want to dance to this, but I will because it's fucking great. It's a great tune. So, you know.
Let me ask you, Berry Gordy, the guy who ran Motown, his instruction to his songwriters was, I want the listeners to know who the song is by in the first four bars, even if they can't name the song. Right, and you'll hear it. You say you accidentally lined up a song and people went wild for it. Can I ask you, right, do you think Noel does that a lot with his kind of chord structures and that kind of thing? Like, I think at gigs it is, and like, he'll start playing If I Had a Gun or Riverman on the last tour, and there's like an outbreak of cheering, assuming it's Wonderwall. Do you think it's like product placement a bit?
It's
not that calculated, no?
I don't think he thinks like that. I mean, he's going to have to play Wonderwall in America because he's going, hey, you're the Wonderwall guy, because Americans are like, fucking, when it comes to music. But
I mean, do you know what I mean? It's exactly the same as Wonderwall. Do you know that? Like, exactly the same.
I just think with Motown, they just sounded like they were having a good time.
Yeah.
Everyone. You can pick any soul song from the 60s, early 60s to early 70s. They all sounded like... They were probably penniless and on the street, but they all sounded like they were having a good time. Whereas nowadays, everyone fucking sounds like they're depressed. And they've probably got a better time than they had. I don't know.
Good point. You once said that Noel looked at Liam as a youngster and to a certain extent wished it could be him in regards to being a front man. Do you think that's still the case now?
Well, I mean, Noel is a front man now in his own thing, but he's not a front man, if you know what I mean. He's like a Johnny Marr, and he's, you know, he's a side man being a front man. And there's more to just getting up there and singing being a front man. And I do notice a difference. I watch Noel's band to going out with BDI, and he's complete opposites. And now Liam, just whatever he does, which is predominantly nothing on the stage, the crowd are mental, and no more so than Rome. Rome last year was probably the best gig I've seen. The gig for the band wasn't amazing, but the crowd are just fucking so mental. They kicked the doors in, then there was a power cut, then there was a stage invasion, all in one Sunday night on the outskirts of Rome, and it's just because of his presence. I'm afraid, I mean, Noel's got the songs, but he hasn't got Lenny's present, and he won't. He'll never have it. They're just different. Together they conquered the world. Apart, no, not as much.
What's your thoughts on his new album?
I mean, I bought it so I can slag it off. I paid 13 quid for the deluxe version. Didn't get a free one. Bought me own. There's a few okay songs on it. It's not really my cup of tea, I mean, really. I like things a bit more up. It's a Noel album. It's not an Oasis album, because I don't think Liam could sing any of them songs, really. I mean, Lock All The Doors was an early Oasis demo.
Oh, man, he's pissed away in Lock All The Doors, and Liam would tear that up, wouldn't he?
Yeah. I just think there's something missing in that record, Liam. But anyway, that's the arguments for another day.
Right, let's talk about the elephant in the room. Oasis do 10 gigs. Liam's voice. Doing world tours.
There's nothing wrong with his voice.
Towards the end of tours? Come on.
Yeah, towards Live. The end of tours. But I mean, how many shows are they doing? You've got to understand that they do 130, 140 gigs. I'll put anyone up to say that your voice isn't going to be fucked after 130, 140 gigs. On the road, travelling overnight, air conditioning in hotels is always a problem. Every frontman will have a problem with air conditioning in hotels. Even if you turn it off.
Yeah.
There's always a problem. Bugs, planes, this, that. That's just fucking not. You watch when Noel goes to America. If there's a few shows in the middle of fucking nowhere that he can't get to, and his voice is, he'll cancel. That's just part and parcel of the job. There's just no way you can be pristine for 140 shows, and I don't care who you are.
And everyone talks about, like, if Liam's written lot of lyrics about Noel and vice versa. Are there any lyrics over the years that you've said, "Oh, I think that's about me," or little references to you?
No, I think I got one dedication in my entire life, and that was because 1994, I commandeered. Oh, in fact, let's get the proper story. I met two kids in Nottingham Rock City, and he said, "Are you going to America to see Oasis at the? I think it was the Wetlands and the CMJ Music Festival." And I said, "No, I'm not. I just can't afford it." I think I was on a dollar at the time, and he says, "All right, well, we'll get your fare. We'll pay your fare if you can get us in the gig." And I says, "Fucking cool, no brainer, innit?" So I got the bus, not the train. I got the bus to Luton, and he picked me up. And I went to Windsor, stayed at his house. Then we got Virgin. You can still smoke on the plane. So I'm on the piss with these fucking two kids. Virgin Airline, fucking Aerostairs, getting there. And I think the gig was in New Jersey. I walked through the door. Liam's like, "Fucking hell, this is cigarettes and alcohol for our kid. I don't know how we fucking got here, but he's here." And I had the best week of my life. Fucking brilliant. And I think I've seen the two guys back at the airport. They didn't have a great time. I think their mate had left them in the loop. They had to sleep in doorways while I was in this girl's posh apartment on Central Park West. I had a great time. They didn't have such a great time. But that was the only dedication I've ever had, I think. They all seem to forget about me. So I'm not just letting me own it.
Let's talk football.
Yeah.
First game you went to was with Noel, I think.
Yeah, Newcastle, 60 odd.
And you used to get him for free, is that right?
Because at City they used to have a free quarter time where they opened the turnstiles after 75 minutes.
After 75?
Yeah. So my dad, being a cheapskate, he said, "Come on, we'll go to the match." So we'd leave at kickoff time, and by the time we got there, because he'd make us walk there, so that'd be like 3 miles. So we walked to the game, we get in 75 minutes. And if it's 0-0, he goes, "You haven't missed anything." And we'd be like, "You made us walk 3 miles," and then you watch the final 15 minutes and go back out again.
Oh, there's a lot of stuff.
It was kind of embarrassing.
How was it seeing Liam and Noel eventually going kind of playing main road?
Yeah, that was a bit of a mad night. That was the same night as Ramadan.
Was it?
Yeah. So you got like 35,000 fans coming out to the streets of Moss Side. Predominantly, you have to go through Rusholme, where you've got the Asians slaughtering lambs on the street.
Really?
It was kind of a bit hectic. I think that was a good gig.
Manchester gigs at 2005 were good ones. You said that.
They were fairly good. Most of the big outdoor shows have been good. I just don't like Wembley Stadium. I just don't. There's just something about that stadium that's not right.
It's soulless there, man. So vacuous.
Even the old one. Even for concerts, it's just. I just don't think bands should play Wembley Stadium. Go and find a big fucking field, and don't play Hyde Park either. Mm. You know, go and play somewhere else.
Talking about filling out stadiums by playing there live, you play Gaelic football, Croke Park, is that right?
Yeah, me and Noel played in the same team in 83 against Kilmacud Crokes, who were probably the champions of Dublin at the time. We played two games, one at their ground and one at Croke Park, and then we did an exchange. Yeah, I can't remember too much about it. I think we were drunk on the way over. We were only kids, so yeah.
But a lot of your work now is like to do. So you're like the secret Gallagher in the secret footballer series, is that right?
Yeah.
And do you know who the secret footballer is?
Yeah, can't tell you.
Really? Do you know?
Yeah, of course I do. I've signed a confidentiality agreement.
Serious?
Yeah. Which reminds me, I haven't written anything for a bit. They were on my case the other day, but I was in Germany. I was like, mate, I mean, not fits there, write anything. So. And
talk to us about the dark days of being an athletics correspondent for Sky Sports.
Because who happened? There's a mate of mine called Harry Pratt, who's mates with Def in Vegas, and I met him through another mate, and he says, do you want to work for Sky? And I'm thinking, where the fuck is Sky? And I found out I was in Austerley, which is the dark ass end of anywhere, so he used to take 2.5 hours to go to work day. And then I started off in football, but then everyone wanted to do football, so I got I ended up doing the boxing, yeah. It was me who started the tail of the tapes and all that shit. And I did athletics, don't know why. I just got shafted in to do sports that nobody gave a shit. I just figured, you know what I mean? I'll do sports that nobody cares about because therefore nobody will nick me stories.
Good thinking.
Yeah, so drugs and athletics and things like that.
Is the story in Tony McCarroll's book true that Liam used to clean Man United players' cars in
the car park?
Yeah,
yeah, he used to work with a guy called Baz. He calls himself the Big Un, but he's Paul Ashby. And he used to valet footballers' cars, predominantly United ones, so Matt Hughes, Cantona, all that kind of stuff, because City players didn't have any cars. I think they had horse and cart back then. So yeah,
there's a story that on his first day, his mates said, right, you've got to go up to Mark Hughes' front door give him the receipt. Uh-huh. Do you know this? Right, and on the receipt, it's supposed to obviously say the money. But he's opened it up and they'd stitched him up, and it says, "I really like your curly hair."
Yeah, I mean, mate, I don't know if that happened, but he did use to valet cars and do shit like
crazy,
that.
Crazy. Okay, let's begin to wrap up. As a DJ, what advice would you give to people on a difficult night if nothing's happening? You know, is it just to lay down the biggest tune you got, or young musicians and young DJs?
There's a few ways of looking at it. Not everybody can dance it. So if you see kind of a semi-empty dance floor and you're thinking, there's a lot of people at the back listening. So you kind of got to... I never just drop a big tune just for the sake of dropping a big tune, because that would be fake. Because therefore you need another big tune after it, another one. So if you drop something that you don't normally play, you're expected to carry on that shit. So I'd rather just wait around. I mean, I predominantly get it. I've got it right. I mean, I've got a 2-hour set at the moment that's pretty fucking banging, to be fair, and it's pretty. I mean, you might get a lull when I stick on Rapper's Delight for 14 minutes, and they're going, "Yeah, I'm fucking sick of this." I say, "Really? Well, you wait till I give you 22 minutes of fucking Noel Falling Down remix, and you'll be pissed off then, won't you?" No, I mean,
And DJ Wars. One of the quotes while I was in Paris was something you said, which is, "He can't fucking follow reggae." Do you remember that?
Yeah, no. Everyone's a DJ these days. I mean, when I started out in the 80s, there was no fucker was a DJ. I mean, apart from the big DJs, and you wouldn't get a chance to play anywhere. But these days, with USB sticks and downloading and everything, everybody I know in the world is a DJ. I mean, it's ludicrous. So that's why I kind of step back from it for a bit, because I don't work in London if I can help it. I help my mates out sometimes, but it's
how much it feel like a job to you now?
It's not a job. You can never if it becomes a job, you can't give it up.
How much you still love it?
I love it and hate it at the same time. I love it, but then I hate it.
Why?
Because you just know it's just. Just travelling is a different crowd. You don't know.
True.
They're all drunk, predominantly. You don't know what to expect. I mean, the thing that I hate about the after shows is people seeing cameras in your face, blinding you with them Carlsey's flashes inside them camera phones. And I mean, I have to take eye drops on a DJ because I just can't see. And I say to him, "Listen, turn your flash off." And they're all drunk, like, "Rah, rah, rah,
fucking still doing it.
Yeah, and they blind you. So while they're blinding me, getting their picture of me that I don't want a fucking picture anyway to put on fucking Facebook and Twitter, you've blinded me so I can't see what I'm fucking doing. So yeah, I kick off and, you know, what can you do? You know, and I can go, what are you complaining for? I'm complaining because I can't see. Fucking hell, I have got a right for my eyes, you know. So yeah, and these phones ain't helping, and new computer screens, they're just fucking with my eyes. So yeah, I've got.
Sound like a job to me, Paul.
Well, no, it's not a job.
I complain less about my job, and it's ain't as good as your one.
No, just slight complaints, you know, planes and, I don't know. Promoters.
Is any pressures touring that we don't see?
No, it's fine. You know, it's just sometimes if you've got two or three on the bounce and the late nights and you've had no sleep, and you know, I apologise to the people of Cologne that didn't play Oasis, you know, every time, but fuck me.
When was that? How long ago was that?
That was about 5 years ago, but it still slagged me off. It still slagged me off now. And when I was in Dusseldorf the other night, I did notice a couple from Cologne and they were predominantly asking me about Oasis. I was like, go and check your fucking ticket. What does it say? It doesn't say I'm fucking going to play every song Oasis, does it? No, do one. So, yeah, you just have a look. Just, you know, whatever.
Finally, how does your current day-to-day life align with the ambitions you had as a kid? What did you want to be and where you are?
Completely different. I mean, I think as a kid, we just wanted a job that paid decent money in Manchester. I think that's what everybody wanted. And then, obviously, the phenomenon that was the Oasis come along that changed everything. So now I'm just kind of happy enough. I'm quite happy doing what I'm doing, just fucking about.
Where are your next DJing? Where's next on the road? You going?
Oh, I'm not doing anything till with Noel. I'm not doing anything with him till July. Clapham. I think we're sourcing venues at the moment. Clapham, Castlefield. So this is, I mean, it does kind of turn into a business, even if you don't want it to. Because if I don't do an after show, I know someone else is going to do it. So it's kind of, you know, I've got a little lineup in my mind for Manchester, pretty good. So I've got to now become a promoter and source other DJs and pay them, and I've got to become the boss. And I'm like, how the fuck did that happen? I just become a DJ. Now I've got to promote it. Which is kind of new, because I usually have promoters in place where I go, someone will ring me up and we'll go, yeah, da, 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 and it's taken care of. But now, some of them I have to do it myself, which doesn't quite sit well. You've got to DJ and promote at the same fucking time from 200 miles away. But anyway, yeah, we've got something in place for Clapham. I'm going to team up with This Feeling, the club night in London. We're going to do something in Clapham, hopefully. Manchester, Cork one, I think has already gone on sale. Where else? Italy, I think me and McGee are looking at doing the three festivals in Italy together. And before that, I've got someone asked me to do a private party in Belgium in June.
Cool. You were at Belgium for a couple of years, weren't you?
Yeah, I mean, I started a club night with a young Belgian kid called Peter Babiki, called Hindu Nights, which is still going, and we did that for a few years. And then yeah, the music policy changed, and I was like, nah, if you're going to do it the same as every other fucking club in the world, carry on. And that's not what I do. I'm not changing. I'm not going to change the music I like just to DJ in Belgium. No. So they carried on doing their thing, and I just went the other way, so it's all fine.
Cool. Final question: what's Liam's next move?
No idea. Probably eating fish. No, I have no idea. What, everyone thinks he's doing a solo album. I have no idea. He hasn't mentioned it to me. So
you're seeing him tomorrow?
Seeing him tomorrow, yeah. We'll go for a leisurely stroll across the heath and
get him in touch with Ashcroft. That's all we know.
Ashcroft? No, he's a red. Can't be working with United fans. Not good sign.
Red and blue don't mix.
Red and blue, you're better dead than red.
Good way to finish. Thanks, Paul.
All right, no problem.
Thanks for having us.
Cheers, Alan Deck.